You're listening to the CyberWire Network, powered by N2K.
Hey, everybody. Today, I want to highlight a name that all of us know well, and that is our sponsor, Splunk. You need to keep operations humming around the clock, but potential disruptions are everywhere. Splunk helps you predict problems and find and fix issues fast so you can reduce risk and ditch downtime. The world's largest enterprises rely on Splunk's unified security and observability platform to become more efficient, resilient, and innovative. With Splunk, you can react quickly, evolve faster, and be ready for anything. Stay ahead of disruptions. Learn more at splunk.com/resilience. And we thank Splunk for sponsoring our show. In the complex world of enterprise identity, securing legacy web apps at scale can be daunting. Strata Identity makes it simple. With Strata, you can effortlessly integrate non-standard apps with any identity service, like MFA or SSO, with zero coding and zero hassle. Designed by identity architects for identity architects, Strata works with every vendor, standard, and app architecture. This means your apps can now speak modern protocols and integrate seamlessly with your chosen identity services. From securing on-prem web apps to migrating away from outdated identity providers or consolidating them, Strata helps you keep your complex access policies as you modernize your identity infrastructure and get rid of technical debt. Join leading organizations like 3M, Dallas County, and CIBC in securing your apps with Strata. Visit strata.io/cyberwire, share your identity security priorities, and receive a complimentary pair of AirPods Pro. Offer valid for organizations with over 5,000 employees. Connect today at strata.io/cyberwire. China's Volt Typhoon snoops into U.S. infrastructure with special attention paid to Guam. Iranian cybercriminals are seen conducting ops against Israeli targets. A new gang uses recycled ransomware. A persistent Brazilian campaign targets Portuguese financial institutions. A new botnet targets the gaming industry. Phishing attempts impersonate OpenAI. Pro-Russian geolocation graffiti. Andrea Little-Limbago from Interos addresses the policy implications of ChatGPT. Our guest is John Check from Raytheon Intelligence and Space on cybersecurity and workforce strategy for the space community. And Killnet says no to slacker hackers. I'm Dave Bittner with your CyberWire Intel briefing for Thursday, May 25th, 2023. A joint advisory from all Five Eyes reports a major Chinese cyber espionage operation that has succeeded in penetrating a wide range of U.S. critical infrastructure sectors. Microsoft, in its own report on Volt Typhoon, as the threat actor is being called, says the group has been active since at least the middle of 2021. The targets of the spying have included a slew of sectors, including communications, manufacturing, transportation, government, IT, and education, among others. Microsoft writes that the threat actor intends to lie low and conduct cyber espionage for as long as they can. It does this, the Five Eyes stress, by carefully living off the land, exploiting existing legitimate administrative tools and privileges in its targets. Much of Volt Typhoon's activity has been directed against Guam, a U.S. territory in the Western Pacific that plays host to important U.S. military bases. Those bases would be important to any U.S. intervention on behalf of Taiwan, should China decide to take a page from Russia's geopolitical playbook and invade what it regards as a renegade province. For its part, China dismisses the reports as American disinformation and denies its involvement in any activity the Five Eyes and Microsoft associate with Volt Typhoon. Two Iranian threat actors have been observed targeting Israeli organizations. The first, Agrius, has been observed conducting ransomware attacks against Israeli entities, Checkpoint reports. What appears to be destructive ransomware attacks are actually masking influence operations, the researchers suggest. The APT group, now calling both itself and its newest ransomware strain Moneybird, has been seen in recent attacks deploying their new C++ ransomware. While the researchers did not elaborate on what organizations were victimized, the record writes the techniques reflect that of Agrius. Public-facing web servers were the initial point of compromise, which, when entered, allowed for reconnaissance and data stealing, as the hackers were able to move laterally within networks. Information Security Buzz reports that another Iranian threat group is attacking Israeli shipping and logistics companies to lift customers' data. Israeli cyber firm ClearSky says, with low confidence, that this may be the work of Tortoiseshell, also known as TA-456 and Imperial Kitten. At least 8 websites were targeted in the campaign, including SNY Cargo, logistics company DepoLog, and restaurant equipment supplier SZM. AI Monitor says what the firm calls a watering hole attack, or an attack infecting the website of a specific group, has also victimized some organizations in the financial services industry. The majority of websites, as of mid-April, had been purged of the malicious code. A new ransomware operation calling itself Booty has been discovered by researchers at Symantec. The tool uses variants of Lockbit and Babook ransomware, as well as a custom info stealer which is able to search for and archive specific file types. The researchers were unable to attribute this new campaign, which has been found to target both Linux and Windows machines, to any known threat actors, and so have dubbed the associated group Blacktail. Sentinel Labs released a report today regarding a campaign that they've observed targeting over 30 Portuguese financial institutions. Researchers assess with high confidence that this campaign is being conducted by a Brazilian threat group, who they've referred to as Operation Magalena. Sentinel Labs writes that this conclusion is further supported by the presence of Brazilian Portuguese language usage within the infrastructure and malware. The threat group's infrastructure shows features that differentiate it from other campaigns. One unique aspect was the existence of 2 simultaneous peeping title variants on the same infected machine. The operation also uses Russian Internet as a Service provider TimeWeb Cloud, which researchers say is known for its lenient anti-abuse policies. The operation uses multiple infection vectors, such as phishing emails, malicious websites advertising fake installers of popular software, and social engineering. Akamai detailed the activities of a new botnet by the name of Dark Frost, observed targeting the gaming industry. The Dark Frost botnet consists of a conglomeration of stolen code from other botnets, particularly Mirai, Gafgit, and Qbot. The threat actor seems driven, at least in part, by a need for attention, as they've been observed on social media channels not only admitting to their illicit botnet creation and use, but have shared live recordings of their attacks. The botnet has launched DDoS attacks against not only gaming companies, but those that are gaming company adjacent, game server hosting companies, online streamers, and various other members of the community. While the malware was unsophisticated, it was capable of significant damage. With an ever-growing amount of source code from existing malware strains readily available, as well as access to AI code generation, threat actors are seeing a significantly lower bar to entry. Inky has detailed a new phishing attack that impersonates ChatGPT creator OpenAI for credential harvesting. The threat actors are using a multitude of techniques in this brand impersonation phishing attack, including spoofing, dynamic redirection, and utilizing malicious links. They falsify an email to appear to be from OpenAI, that the researchers say looks nearly identical to the one users receive when they sign up for a new ChatGPT OpenAI account. The hackers spoof the email address to appear to come from the IT department of the receiver. They swap out the safe link in the legitimate email for a malicious link that asks for a user's credentials. If they're entered, then they're stolen. The UK's Ministry of Defense this morning pointed out a geolocation spoofing stunt. They wrote that analysis by Geolect indicates that since the 14th of May, 2023, commercial vessels' automatic identification system data has been remotely spoofed to create the impression of a 65-kilometer-long Russian pro-war Z symbol on the Black Sea, visible on open-source tracking software. The tracks reportedly show the vessel's speeds as upward of the rather implausible 102 knots, or just under 120 miles per hour, adding further evidence that the reports were fake. Spoofing AIS, which the Defense Ministry says is used to track vessels and ensure their safety, increases maritime accident risk. The ministry credits pro-Russian actors who likely conducted the spoofing as an information operation, potentially in an attempt to bolster Russian morale ahead of an anticipated Ukrainian counteroffensive. And finally, if you were wondering how things are in the world of cyber auxiliaries, privateers, and general no-goodniks, Killnet's boss spokesperson, Kill Milk, this week announced that he was firing a bunch of his hacktivists. The Russian outlet Lenta.ru reports that Killnet participants cite clearing out groups from the gang that are insufficiently professionally contributing to attacks against the West. So, hacktivists, up your game or you're out. Coming up after the break, Andrea Little-Limbago from Interos addresses the policy implications of ChatGPT. Our guest is John Check from Raytheon Intelligence and Space on cybersecurity and workforce strategy for the space community. Stay with us. John Check is Executive Director of Cyber Protection Solutions at Raytheon Intelligence and Space. In collaboration with my N2K colleagues on the T-Minus podcast, I caught up with him at the RSA conference for insights on cybersecurity and workforce strategy for the space community. Can you give us some insights as to what the situation is on the ground? I mean, I know we talk over on the cybersecurity side about that there are skills gaps, that there's challenges in hiring people. Is it pretty much the same in space?
Yes, I would say in space, the same rules apply, right? There's the skills gap, it's lack of diversity, right? Something that we also need to address. Because, I mean, space is, it has Earth's problems. It's all the same thing.
I love it.
Right? Just in a different level of the atmosphere.
Right, right. Even when we build that moon base, it'll be the same.
All the same rules and problems will apply to the moon, I'm sure.
So how are you and your colleagues at Raytheon coming at that to try to narrow those gaps?
Well, one of the key things is making sure that there's context. So to solve any problem, you really need to have the people that are deep into cyber that are here to do all the right things around that, which would be implementing the zero trust pillars, ensuring that you're doing all the things to secure an environment, but also marrying them up with people with deep space knowledge, people that understand how satellites work, how the communications work between ground stations and those things floating above us, and how do they talk between them? So you put those two contexts together. You just can't just have ultimately cyber is a team sport. Mm-hmm. And that requires all players to be engaged in helping each other fill the gaps that they don't have in knowledge. And that's one of the critical learnings we have within Raytheon is we have a part of our business that does offensive cyber. So we've developed something we call Raytheon Offensive Labs, where we teach our defenders to think like an attacker, which means that's a totally different mindset you approach a problem to versus one of the gaps we have in traditional learning. I'll say in traditional colleges and universities, they do great work, but they don't teach offensive cyber. Programs, that's typically learned by somebody that has an interest in cyber, and they're doing that in a cyber defense competition where they're defending against a red team that's trying to attack their fictitious network for supporting a company, or a CTF, or one of those other aspects to where you get more of the flavor of, okay, the greatest thing ever, my most enjoyable experiences in cyber are after you do an exercise like that, and the red teamers are out briefing the teams that they were attacking, and the conversations are the best. Mm. Because they're like, oh yeah, when you typed in that 100-character password, and it took you 30 seconds to do that, we'd already seen it, cut and paste it, and we're owning everything you had at that point.
Wow.
So it's a great dialogue because that person's not even thinking. They're thinking, I'm being super secure because I'm doing a 100-character password.
Right.
And taking the time. Meanwhile, the attacker's like, yeah, I could see you doing it the whole time. I was just cutting and pasting and putting it where I needed to go next in your network. So it's great. Those are learnings that have to continue. And I think space will exactly the same rules apply. And that's what we're really focused on is how do we marry the, okay, here's what attackers would do in space. What does it look like in a cyber vector? And how do we ensure that the defenders understand what that looks like?
And in a situation like that, to see it be able to be done in a collaborative way, you know, there's an adversarial element to it, but at the end of the day, in that particular case, everybody's on the same team.
100%. And it really is. I mean, people look forward to that. That's mm-hmm. like one of the highlights, because that's when you truly get the learnings of when you were doing all. And over time, one of the things we participate in is the National Collegiate Cyber Defense Competition, which is in its 18th year this year. And so there's absolutely been the maturity level of the teams that come to participate each year from the colleges and universities has greatly improved. Right? They've clearly learned and are way more advanced than they were when the competition started.
When it comes to the security of satellites, for example, in a previous life, I worked in the television industry back in the 90s, and I remember talking to my friends in Master Control who were responsible for the uplinks and things like that, and I remember, you know, they would use phrases like, let's light this candle, and things like that, right? But I also remember asking them, like, how are we ensuring that we're not stepping on each other's signals? What keeps someone from, you know, lighting up an uplink and just stomping on someone else's signal? And the response I got over and over again was, well, we're gentlemen. We would not do that. I suspect we're probably not 100% in that mode anymore with the dependence on satellites that we have now, the global arena and the having adversaries out there. Is that an accurate view from my point of view?
I would say, without a doubt, people, and I'm not going to say would become complacent, but certainly, okay, great, that communication you have from the ground to the satellite is encrypted. Okay, but once that satellite's up there, what are all the sensors it has that can receive input?
Yeah.
How are other outside entities trying to, you know, reach your security through those other sensors and other vectors, even outside of just what the communications link is? I don't think satellite manufacturers have the same challenges that everybody else does. There's a lot of times when people release products, there are other features like microphones or RF capabilities that are turned off,
mm-hmm.
but it's still out there. It still has the capability. So if an attacker knows a feature that's on something, they just upload the driver, start taking advantage of it, move laterally within that platform.
Yeah.
So it's really something you have to think about. It's not just the straightforward attack vectors. When you think like an attacker, okay, what comprises this? What are all the different components? How do I test each component to
right.
figure out what is the way I would be compromised? And as a defender, that's exactly the things we need to make sure we're locked down. If you really don't need a certain sensor on a satellite, don't put it up there and shoot it up in space with it on.
Well, I was thinking, along those lines that, I imagine the conversation when someone walks into their boss's office and says, I accidentally bricked the router. You know, that's a different conversation than, boss, I accidentally bricked the satellite.
Right.
Because you can't just swap out something that's in geosynchronous orbit.
Well, it's interesting because from my perspective, I feel like at the terrestrial level, OT systems and space, they have to share a lot of the same challenges, right? OT systems, a lot have been around a long years. There's a lot of satellites that were launched a long time ago when cybersecurity wasn't a concern.
Right.
So you get that whole aspect of it. The satellites can't be, you don't take them down for downtime, right?
Yeah.
To swap out parts. I mean, in the OT systems, it runs.
Right.
And you do not mess with it.
You're changing the oil while the engine is running.
So there's certain aspects. I mean, obviously you can get physical access to some OT systems.
Well, we don't have a space shuttle anymore.
Right. Yeah, that's really made me think about it. There's definitely some similarities. So one of the things I'm more focused on currently is how do you treat some of those same challenges? Because, you know, like a smart person once told me, everybody's a unique snowflake, but human behaviors are all the same.
Hmm.
And with cybersecurity, space is a unique environment, but all the cybersecurity challenges, opportunities exist the same there as they do here on Earth.
As you head back after a conference like this, what sort of things are on your mind? Do you find yourself energized, a little overwhelmed? What are you going to bring back to your team and your colleagues?
Well, I'm a continuous reframer. So I'm always a glass is almost always full type of person.
Mm.
I'm there to solve the challenges that are come up. I'm not there to worry about them. That doesn't help anything. So one of the key things I'm going to take away from this conference is making sure the team knows we are making progress. There are good things that are happening, right? You can be overwhelmed by all the things that aren't good, but there's a lot of goodness that's coming out. There's a lot better collaboration. There's starting to be true information sharing, not just for the purpose of, hey, here's my information, but people are taking action related to it. They're starting to really, you know, we're getting through the formative stages. Mm-hmm. Maybe we're close to the end of the beginning to where we can really move on and truly start collaborating, because within cybersecurity, without a doubt, 100%, no one can defend on their own. Unless you have an environment that you've cultivated over time, which starts with ensuring that you are doing everything you can to persist the fight as long as we can. So from my perspective, if somebody on my team finds another job at another company, I'm thrilled. I'm so totally supportive, because that means there's another friend of mine out there that I can call that will get new experiences that I will probably rely on, or they'll rely on me at some point in the future to figure out and solve some tough problems. And that's what, you know, when you think about what's your goal of why you're doing things, that's where I really try to hone in on. I mean, my goal is to protect our way of life, point blank, and persist the fight. After when I'm long gone, you know, sitting on a porch, napping next to the cat that's also napping, you know, I'll be sleeping soundly, because I know that there'll be a great next team focused on solving the cybersecurity problems of the day that will be way beyond the problems I experienced when I was doing it.
That's John Check from Raytheon Intelligence and Space. You can hear more of my conversation with him on today's T-Minus Daily Space Intel Briefing.
And I am pleased to be joined once again by Andrea Little-Limbago. She is Senior Vice President for Research and Analysis at Interos. Andrea, it's always great to have you back. You know, ChatGPT has been in the news a lot, and I wanted to touch base with you about these language models and what we're seeing around the world responding to this when it comes to policy.
Yeah, no, thanks, Dave. And it is. There's been great discussion about the technology, and there's been a lot of sort of fun discussions on what we can do as far as making emails sound like they were written by Shakespeare and so forth. And there obviously is some benefits going along with it, but there also is the negative side, where we do see aspects of encouraging hate speech, false information, and so forth. There's actually some new words are being coined based upon this, hallucitations, because some of the citations created are fake that go along with it. And so it adds a lot of complexity that, you know, it may say something is very valid, a cite a Washington Post article, and turns out the article does not exist. So there's hallucitations that go along with that. There's algorithmic disgorgement, which goes along with what, to the point on the policy side, it's the penalty that the FTC can now wield against companies. And so when they are using deceptive practices on how they obtain the data for train that's required for training the algorithms. And so basically what they have been able to do, and this has been since Cambridge Analytica, so it's been not just in response to ChatGPT, but we're going to obviously see a growing usage of it, that companies need to erase those algorithms if they were using data without consent for training. That's why one of the bigger aspects in the US is the FTC, and there's also an AI copyright lawsuit going on. It's the first class action lawsuit in the US against GitHub and some of the training and output of some of their work. Mm-hmm. But then even more globally, we're seeing Canada, Italy, Spain, and some EU working groups brought together to either review or block. Italy's taken the stance of trying to block the use of it. Spain just announced recently that they're reviewing now whether they want to be blocking it as well. And they're going to start bringing some coordination across the EU in that regard. Because some of the concerns over some of the false and negative information that can come from it, as well as the lack of consent required for some of the training. You can especially think about, you know, facial recognition is a train without the consent of the people, but then also copyright infringement by training on articles that should be copyrighted. So there's a whole range there. And it's everything from, you know, sort of at that level to in Australia, there's a mayor who is suing because what the output of ChatGPT said for him was that he was a current mayor, that he was in jail when he was actually the whistleblower that put someone in jail. So just, you know, not just, but there are things along those lines that continue to happen. There are, you know, it's almost, you know, defamation suits where information about someone may be false. You know, there's an example recently where one professor looked up other professor, basically asked, you know, who are all the professors that had sexual harassment claims against them? And the list was not accurate. And so that can be really, as you can imagine, really harmful to someone if their name were to show up on that list and be taken as truth. So there's a lot of issues starting to go along with it. They're going to start, I think, imposing some guardrails going forward. And it's interesting that it's really been quite quick on the policy side, you know, much faster than we've seen in some other areas.
Why do you suppose it's been so quick? Is it the amount of attention that it's gotten?
I think that helps with it. And then I think also just the accessibility of it. So if you think about it, I mean, kids are able to use it to help explore and write papers at this point. So it's very, you know, the user experience goes along with them. That makes it very useful for anyone to be able to use. And I think that alone makes it much more omnipresent than something that would require someone to, you have a computer science PhD to leverage algorithms. So I think the usability really played a big role in it. I think that coupled with, you know, there was a data breach that occurred a little while ago where some of the search history was leaked along with some payment information. I think that also added to it. The biggest probably impetus was the usability and how quickly it spread.
Do we have any elections coming up where there's concern? I mean, obviously the U.S. in 2024, but anything on a closer horizon where folks have raised an issue here that there's concerns?
That's a good point. I think more broadly, there's just growing concern around all elections as far as deep fakes, then even, you know, voice mimicry, where it sounds like a politician saying something that they never actually said. And we are seeing, you know, we saw a fair amount of that in the last presidential election, and there has been different aspects of that popping up across the globe. So that for sure is something to be concerned about. There were some instances in Nigeria over their recent election and some protests where a lot of disinformation was exposed that then led to, you know, ethnic conflict in the area. So it's, you know, it's a whole range, and some of that can be automated. And that's where, you know, when you get the connection of, you know, bots with disinformation to help it spread, it's again where some of the algorithms come in and really get to the widespread nature of it.
Are you optimistic that there's going to be policy solutions to this? As you say, I mean, the response has been quick, which I suppose is refreshing and good, but is this something we're equipped to handle?
I'm not sure. And that's where I think we're going to learn a lot over the next year for what may be working and what doesn't. Because on the one hand, you know, I mean, it's interesting that, you know, for under Wassenaar at one point, which is preventing dual use technologies, there was a discussion on how to treat encryption and then a little bit of a discussion on algorithms. And, you know, part of the pushback was, well, how do you ban math? Mm-hmm. And, you know, that does make it very hard. So I think there's going to be sort of that tendency coupled with a tendency for, you know, ideally more of a, you know, guardrail approach that basically helps, you know, provide guidance on how to properly get training data and consent and so forth. And that could actually help move forward, you know, quite well and progressive. I do worry about the all-out blocking and banning of it, because I do think that when you ban very capable technologies for some and not others, that then puts you at a disadvantage. So I think I'm optimistic that we can find ways to leverage generative AI in a way that can be beneficial and provide the, you know, the force multiplying power that it could, while still protecting and preserving people's their profiles, the defamation, and help train it in a better way. But I think it's going to be a long ways to go. There's going to be a lot of trial and error. I think we'll see over the next few years.
Yeah. All right. Well, Andrea Little-Limbago, thanks for joining us. Don't struggle to align your organization's cybersecurity with business risk. Get the only solution that goes beyond reacting to threats with vulnerability and risk monitoring. You need the next evolution of MDR, and only Critical Start delivers it. Critical Start doesn't just monitor and respond to threats. They put you in control by detecting suspicious activities, quickly responding to contain threats, and identifying your most critical assets and protecting them against vulnerabilities and exposures. With continuous visibility, expert guidance, and measurable risk reduction, Critical Start has redefined what it means to manage cyber risk. Demonstrate provable security maturity to your leadership while positioning your program to achieve the greatest risk reduction per dollar spent. Stop fearing risk and start managing it with Critical Start. Visit criticalstart.com and request a demo today. That's criticalstart.com. And that's the CyberWire. For links to all of today's stories, check out our daily briefing at thecyberwire.com. We're privileged that N2K and podcasts like The CyberWire are part of the daily intelligence routine of many of the influential leaders and operators in the public and private sector, as well as the critical security teams supporting the Fortune 500 and many of the world's preeminent intelligence and law enforcement agencies. N2K Strategic Workforce Intelligence optimizes the value of your biggest investment, your people. We make you smarter about your team while making your team smarter. Learn more at n2k.com. This episode was produced by Liz Irvin and senior producer Jennifer Iben. Our mixer is Trey Hester, with original music by Elliot Peltzman. The show was written by Rachel Gelfand. Our executive editor is Peter Kilpie, and I'm Dave Bittner. Thanks for listening. We'll see you back here tomorrow.